Good morning and welcome to Victory. Preachers love Mother's Day because mamas get their families to church. So great job, moms. So glad to see so many of you gather here today. And I want to give a few shout outs to everybody online. Karen Cadwell, Gosport, happy Mother's Day, mom. Also want to welcome all the moms at the Indy campus. Happy Mother's Day up there. Amanda and Ashley and so many others. Margaret in Cincinnati is a part of Victory Everywhere. Happy Mother's Day to my mother-in-law. And happy Mother's Day to all of you who are here. We just love to celebrate mothers here. I hope you felt that when you walked through the door and got yourself a cookie. Personally, I'm thankful for moms because I have a mom and I married a fantastic mother, right? Who does a great job of being a mom. My wife is fantastic. And from my vantage point, I know that moms have a hard job. Like moms are under a lot of pressure. In fact, in a single day, a mom can be a nurturer, a chef, a coach, a cheerleader, a taxi cab driver, a psychologist, a therapist, an ER doctor, a banker, a theologian, an inspirational speech writer, and you have to be a mind reader. And that's a lot of pressure. That's just a huge to-do list. That being a mom can be tiring. Being a mom, from my perspective, can be overwhelming. The schedules, the responsibilities, the pressure to make sure, because you take this on yourself, to make sure everybody looks good, make sure everybody's fed, make sure everybody's getting along. That's a lot of pressure. And social media, like today, it just compounds the pressure. Not only are you tired and overwhelmed, even the best moms, I believe even the best moms, they'll get out on social media and they begin to feel insecure. Why can't we have the clothes that they have? Or why can't we have the budget that they have? Or why can't we have a family picture where everybody's smiling and nobody's fighting and everybody's looking at the camera like they have? Let's be real. You don't know what happened before that picture or after that picture. They probably put somebody in a headlock. But you see it out there, and whenever you see it, your first thought isn't, oh, they look cute. I am glad they're having so much fun. I hope they take 15 vacations and post pictures on it about every single one. No, what happened? Insecurity creeps in. Comparison creeps in. Overthinking, constant pressure. And in the middle of our story, we're always searching for something else. I mean, if you have young kids, you're dying to have an adult conversation. If you have older kids, you're dying to have any conversation. You're trying to wrangle them back in from their moving from thing to thing to thing. It is exhausting. And I also know this, that Mother's Day, it's supposed to be a day of celebration. Like, I really do hope you got a cookie. They're good. But let's acknowledge that some dread Mother's Day. For some of them, Mother's Day is a terrible reminder that your mom isn't here, or that no matter how hard you tried, you just never got your shot at being a mom. Or, transparently, it could be full of regret of the decisions you made when maybe you were just a young and inexperienced mom. So I don't know who's here today feeling tired, overwhelmed, insecure this Mother's Day. But part of the reason I think that people do that is because with motherhood, there's no graduation date. You never stop being a mom. There's no finish line or I completed the projects. Every time there's just new challenges. So no wonder it's so tiring. And thankfully, I don't know what it's like to be a mom, right? Thankfully, but when I'm worn out, so this is me, I'm not projecting on you, but when I'm worn out, I begin to wonder. And when I'm worn out, I question my purpose, I question my calling, I question my position in life, I question my ability, and I've tried. And by the looks of it, I've failed. I don't know how you feel, but when I'm worn out, I wonder. And it's worse because when we get trapped in these like little slivers of life, these little moments of life, just these slices of life with all of the stresses and all of the pressures and all of the expectations and all of the responsibilities, there can be certain moments where we evaluate where we are in that moment and we stand back and we just think, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed of what I haven't done. I'm ashamed about what I can't do. I just feel ashamed. I thought I knew what I was supposed to accomplish. I thought if I sacrificed or if I persisted, I would see progress. When you're worn out, I think that it really is in all of us to tend to question our calling, God's involvement in our life, question our ability to do what God has for us to do. Now, when I get worn out, I realize I don't always feel that way. I mean, I've always been a dreamer. I've always thought that the best is yet to come, and I really do believe that. I've always thought that I would never give up. But when I get worn out, I stop dreaming. When I get worn out, I think this isn't what I had planned for my life. I don't know if anyone else is feeling that. How did I get here? I thought by now it would feel different. When we're worn out, we begin to wonder, will we ever do or become what we're supposed to do or be or become? And if you've ever felt that, the person that we're going to look at in Scripture could raise their hand and say, me too. You're not alone. When we read the Bible, just a reminder, there aren't perfect people. You won't find perfect people in the Bible. You'll find people like you and people like me who faced a lot of pressure, people who had great responsibility. So since it's Mother's Day, we're going to go all girl power today. We're going to look at a life of a woman named Esther. Now, if you were to fast forward to the end of her life account, and you would be tempted to think, oh, Esther, she's a rock star, right? Our girl E, by the end of the account, she has looks, she has money, she has power, she has fame. In fact, if you were to grow up in Persia like she grew up in Persia, her name literally means star. But what I think that she would say to you today is simply this. You only think that because you're looking at my whole life. You only think that because you're looking, judging me by the end of my life. You had no idea how I was feeling in the middle of my life story. Now, you might be here today and you might be thinking, I'm not in the middle. Like, I'm closer to the end of the story. I just need you to know, I believe with all of my core that if you're not dead, God's not done with you. If you're not dead, God's not done. And with all of your life experience, you already know this, that if you were to take a time machine and go back and drop into the middle of your 20s or go back and drop into the middle of your 30s or go back to high school and drop in the middle of a chemistry final exam, in the middle, you'll know this, things are messy. In the middle, things like clarity and hope, they can be hard to come by. And from the middle, it's really hard to see how things are gonna actually end up for us. And now beginnings, remember beginnings, they're exciting. They set off on a grand adventure. Endings are great. They can feel magical. They live happily ever after, but that's not where we are. Where are we at? In the middle, far from the excitement of the beginning, and you can't say with any confidence in the end that even if you try your best, you will get where you intended to go. We are in the middle. And in the middle, we all begin to question our ability to do or be what we're supposed to do or be or become. And if you're feeling that today, I want just to wash over you, right? Because we want miracles in our lives, but we spend our whole time trying to avoid the context in which miracles happen. But we do. We all want these miracles in our life. We want to see God move. We want to be a part of something miraculous. But we desperately try to avoid the stress, the pain, the helplessness, the unknown in which these miracles happen. And here's what we already know. There are no miracles in the middle. Happy Mother's Day. But so today, we're going to do things just a little bit different. We're going to scan the whole life of Esther. If you've never read it before, it's a fantastic book. It's only 10 chapters. And I know you need to know that it's Mother's Day, so to talk about the life of Esther, I'm going to give like a Bible disclaimer. It's in the Bible, not endorsed by the Bible, because some of the stuff in her life account is pretty dicey, so I'm going to dress it up because it's Mother's Day, but it's like Animal House and Hangover and Bachelor and CSI and Purge and Sleepless in Seattle, like all in one. Like, honestly, you should read it. It's a murder mystery. It's a romance. It's a thriller. So we're going to scan her whole life, and you will get, I promise, you will get the happily ever after. I'm going to give it to you. It's going to be great, but then we're going to circle back around, and I'm going to give us our challenge for today. So you ready? It doesn't matter. So we're going to do it anyway. Now, to really grasp the whole measure of the pressure that this woman was under, I'm going to take you all the way back to the beginning of her account. So if you have your Bible or mobile device, Esther 1 is where we're going. And as you're turning there, I'm going to give you the setting. So in the setting, it was in Persia around 470 BC. This is the whole covering of Persia's reign. This is what they had. And the capital is over here in Susa, and Jerusalem is over here. So this is real history, a place that you could go and visit today. In fact, movies have been written about this guy that we're going to talk about. Have you ever seen 300? It's about the Persians invading Sparta and Greece. So the king that's in charge of the million-man army in 300 is King Xerxes. This is how Hollywood pictures him. In Esther chapter 1, he's rich, he's strong, he's intimidating, he's a murderous king, and he's throwing a killer party. In fact, his party lasts 180 days. That's a party, right? Like, we're going to have a party. Come on over. Well, how long is it going to last? Till Thanksgiving. Like, come on. It's going to be great, right? If you're a school teacher, it's going to last all year, 180 days. It's like Animal House, you know? So Xerxes throws this killer party, and he pays for everything. And it says in the Bible that at this party, there were no rules, no restrictions, no limits. They had one rule, and that'll be important later. But here is the one rule. Nobody tells Xerxes no. Nobody tells him no. Now, Xerxes, to his people, were considered to be divine. So he's like a little g god in their culture. Anything he says goes. So it says that they're sitting on gold couches, sipping the best wine from gold goblets. Can you just imagine the rap songs that you could have written back then? Would have been awesome. So after 6 months, the party ends, but don't worry. Xerxes and his boys, he throws an after party. After a 180-day party, we need to party some more. And on the seventh day of the after party, he's drunk and out of his mind, and he sends a message to his wife. So this is like Old Testament drunk texting. Now, at the time, his wife is not Esther. Told you this is messy, right? So his wife at the time is Queen Vashti, and she's having a party for all the women. And in the text message, it goes a little something like this. Bring Queen Vashti, and I want her to dance for all of my buddies, and I want her to wear her crown and only her crown. The text says he did this in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. It's in the Bible. Now remember, there's one rule in the kingdom. Nobody tells Xerxes no. But apparently, Queen Vashti didn't get the memo. It says, but when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Now, I know this is like way different than the VeggieTales version you grew up with, right? The king became furious and he burned with anger. And so the rejected King Xerxes is embarrassed and he gets mad and he asks his buddies, hey, I want you to give me advice. Now, guys, this is not a good idea. But the guys, his buddies were distraught because here's what they're thinking. If your wife can tell you no and you're the king, that'll go all over our kingdom, all the way from India to Europe. Our wives will think that they can tell us no. Happy Mother's Day, right? So, great King Xerxes, you've got to do something about this. This is how they say it. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the law of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, because we don't want you to change your mind, right? That Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And not only that, also let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than her. She is. King, you deserve better than this. So this mad drunk king takes terrible advice from his drinking buddies, right? And I just goes, I don't ever want to see her again. Last drunk text. That's chapter one. Chapter two basically opens like a scene from the movie Hangover. King Xerxes sobers up and he figures out, oh my gosh, what have I done to my beautiful queen? It's like, I can't believe it. She's hot and now I'm lonely and I don't want to stay lonely. So he has another bad decision. He gets all of his buddies together one more time and says, guys, help me out. And their answer is simply this: have a beauty pageant and the winner gets to be your wife. And I'll paraphrase what they said. Oh, powerful ruler, you're the greatest ruler on the kingdom of earth. You rule from India to Europe. So send talent evaluators out to collect the most beautiful women of the world, give them spa treatments for a year, and then pick the one that you like best to be queen. And the rest, you can just add to your harem. Now, I know it's not the best text for Mother's Day. It's a little messy. But this is an account of a heroic woman's faith that saves a whole nation of people. I just want you to know that's not what it looks like in the middle. It's not what it looks like in the middle. This advice appealed to the king and he followed it. Now, in my opinion, what happened next is the very first taping of the very first season of The Bachelor. Right? That's what happened. Now in Susa, there's a Jewish man named Mordecai. Get this, Mordecai, he wrote the account of Esther. And Mordecai is in Susa because his great-great-grandpa was taken captive with Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So this history is connected. And some of the Israelites went home, but Mordecai stayed. And he's raising the daughter of his uncle who passed away. And her name is our girl E, Esther. It's a second cousin, technically, but he's raising her as his daughter, and he sends Esther to the Miss Susa contest, but he tells Esther, don't tell anyone you're Jewish. And she received 12 months of beauty treatments. And so Esther's working out. She's exfoliating. She looks good. She smells good, right? And I won't go into the detail of the audition process because it's Mother's Day. But in Esther 2:16, it's the decision day. And I want you to look at how it was written. This is written, taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month of the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign. So this is history. This is not once upon a time. So this is the day of the final rose ceremony. And here's what's on the line of accepting the final rose. First place is queen. Second place is slavery for the rest of your life. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, so he sent a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. All right. Now, the end of chapter 2 plays out like CSI, because Mordecai, he's waiting at the king's gate to hear the outcome of who is chosen on The Bachelor, right? And while he's there, he overhears a plan to assassinate King Xerxes. Somehow he gets the message to Esther that two of the king's officers are plotting to kill Xerxes, and she tells the king, and the rebels are impaled in poles. Guys, this is, again, awesome, right? But I want you to look at how chapter 2 ends, and this is important for later. All of this is recorded in the book of the Annals. Like, this is, it makes it into the history books. Now, chapter 3 opens up with the villain of the account. His name is Haman. So think Jafar from Aladdin. Got it? Right? He has influence. He has power. He's the king's trusted advisor, but he shouldn't be trusted. He has a huge ego. So he asks the king, this is history. He make a decree that when I walk through the town, everybody has to bow down to me. And everyone bows down to him except one guy. It's our guy, Mordecai. Crazy Uncle Mordecai, and which drives Haman mad. He's so mad, he wants Mordecai to die. Not just that, he wants the whole race of the Jewish people to die. Can you imagine being that mad? Which, it sounds crazy, but it was generational racism. Now, it can actually be traced all the way back through Jewish history. The Jews versus the Amalekites. They were relentless enemies of God's people all over the Old Testament. And the Bible beef goes all the way back to Genesis 25 of Jacob and Esau. Like, generational hatred. But in Esther 3, it escalates to genocide. And the only problem is Haman doesn't have the authority to kill anyone. So he goes to the king with a plan. He sells this story. Great king. There's these people that don't obey your laws. They don't bow down to me. And they disrespect you every day. I walk by, right? Not only that, but oh, king, they're worth, and he gives a figure, but I did the math. It's worth about $2 billion in today's money. He says, if I kill them, I'll just give all that money to you. So he's suggesting Old Testament purge. And King Xerxes is like, I don't like needlessly killing people, but $2 billion for getting rid of people who are disobedient? Sign me up. I don't even know a Jewish person. He doesn't know he's married to one. Esther never told him. Sounds like a very healthy marriage, right? And so the king signs a new law, and they cast lots for a day to annihilate the Jews, and it landed on March 7th of the following year. Like, anybody in the kingdom could legally kill a Jew on that day. So just, can you imagine being in that, and just imagine knowing that a year from now that you're going to die and your family's going to die and nobody's going to try to help you at all. That's how chapter 3 ends. In chapter 4, Mordecai finds out about this plan, but Esther has no clue. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes, and he went into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. Now, that is how they mourned back in the day. But Esther doesn't know why he's down, but she sees him at a distance. And ladies, I'm telling you, this is how you know the Bible isn't made up. Right? I want you to read this. She sees a person in need and says, I know what he needs, new clothes. Check this out. And when Esther's eunuchs and female attendants came, he told her about Mordecai. She was in great distress. She sent clothes for him. Right? Retail therapy was alive back then. You're down, let's go shopping, right? So her servants come back and let her know that Mordecai is down because National Kill a Jew Day is on the calendar. So he tells Esther to beg the king to change his mind. But the problem is, remember the only rule? No one tells Xerxes no. That's what actually got the last queen taken out. And so here she is in the middle of her story. In the middle of it. And she's got to be feeling unqualified, overwhelmed. She's got to think, okay, how did I get here? I know she's thinking this. This isn't what I had planned for my life. Why do I know that? Because that's how we all feel in the middle. And there's so much pressure. In fact, there's more pressure than what we think because there's this law that if Esther even knocks on the door and interrupts the king, she can rightly receive the death penalty. No one sees the king unless they're invited. And at this point, Esther has been married to the king for 5 years, but he hasn't asked to even see her for over a month. He's doing fine without her. Not a good time to interrupt the most powerful man on the face of the planet and say, I have the secret heritage and a huge favor. Let me go shopping. Like, not a great time to do that. So she sends this message back to her cousin slash dad, Mordecai. It's simply this. Sorry, Mo, I can't go. I worked on that, no? Okay. Mordecai sends this message back. Simply, do not... You wonder what I do. Like, I worked on that. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you're alone. You alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. I'm trusting God. But you and your father's family will perish. And then he says this, and who knows? But that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Esther, maybe the reason God put you here is not to enjoy a life of royalty, but to face this specific difficulty. Maybe the reason God put you here is not to seek happiness every single day of your life, but to actually make a difference with your life. Now, this isn't how Esther dreamed her life would go. And so this makes her desperate. So she says, Mordecai, if I'm going to do this, basically she doesn't say these words, but she said, I need God. Have every Jewish person you know spend the next 30 days fasting and praying. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. I don't want to do this. But I want you to see her resolve. I want you to feel her commitment. Even though she was anxious, she has this conviction. And she says, and if I perish, I perish. I'll do it, but I don't think I'll survive it. If I perish, I perish. And that's chapter 4. Chapter 5 is pardon the interruption, PTI, guys. Now, Esther gets all dressed up. She's looking like a queen because now she's recognizing that God has positioned her. That's where God strategically placed her. So let me just ask you, despite your own circumstance, do you own the position that God has given you? Like this Mother's Day, not just moms, everybody. Do you believe that you were strategically positioned by God? That God has a specific purpose and plan, and he's moving and active in your life. I know as you look around at this age and stage that you're currently in, do you actually believe that God put you there and has a job for you to do? Do you own the position that God has given you? This is the moment of transition because the queen owns her position and makes her way towards the king's chamber. And every step could be another step closer to death. She stands outside the king's door and it opens and he invites her in and says, wow, let me say that backwards. Wow, she's looking fine today. I haven't seen this girl in a month. Come on over here, my translation. And then look at what he says next. After all of that praying and fasting, he says, what is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you. Ask for anything. Look at what she asked for. If it pleases the king, replies Esther, let the king together with Haman come together today to a banquet I have prepared for him. So the king and Haman go to the feast that night. And as they're drinking wine, the king asked Esther, what is your petition? It will be given to you. And what is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. And you know what she asked for? Another dinner with the king and Haman. Now, I don't know why she keeps inviting Haman to all of the dinners. Like one commentator suggested that it was to make the king jealous. We don't know, but we do know that she has to feel overwhelmed because so far her plan to save the world is to invite a guy trying to kill her and the king to dinner. How's the plan going? We'll invite him to another dinner. Now, Haman walks out of that. He's feeling good. The king loves me. The queen loves me. National Kill of Jude is on the calendar. He's strolling and he's walking home from work that night. And everyone's bowing down to him until he gets to the gate and he sees Mordecai. Do you ever just see somebody and your blood starts boiling? Right? Mordecai, he drives Haman crazy. And anything good he was feeling is replaced by anger and hate. And he does what most men do when they have a bad day. Haman goes home and whines to his wife about how hard his life is. And she basically says, "You're a big boy, do something about it. Quit complaining." Wives today are so much more compassionate. They would never say anything like that. So he builds this huge gallows and they hang Mordecai on it. And then he says, "If you do that, the people will respect you." Well, Haman loves the idea, so he builds this huge gallows, 75 feet high. That's chapter 5, and chapter 6 is sleepless in Susa. The night the king could not sleep, so he ordered the book of Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. So he's like, can't sleep in the middle of the night. I know, I'll study history. It always puts me to sleep. So I want you to look at what was read to him. It was found recorded that Mordecai had exposed two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. And he's like, "Oh yeah, I remember that. Did we ever do anything for him? He saved my life." They said nothing had been done for him. His attendants answered, and the king said, "Who is in the court right now?" So Haman is in the court. He's on his way to see the king so that he can kill Mordecai. He wants to impale Mordecai on the gallows, but the king invites him in and says, "Hey, Haman, what should be done for the man that the king delights to honor?" Well, Haman thinks it's him. So he's like, "What do I want? I've been thinking about this, right? For the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with the royal crest placed on its head." Then I'm just making this up as I go. Like, it's like he's been thinking about this. "Let the robe and the horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes, and let the robe of the man the king delights to honor, or let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.'" And the king says, "Go at once and get the robe and the horse, do it just as you suggested for Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended." And so Haman, go give the royal treatment to the guy you want to murder. It's going to be a great thing. Now, remember, what's the only rule in the kingdom? No one tells the king no. And so Haman got the robe and the horse, and he robed Mordecai, and he led him on the horseback through the streets, proclaiming before him, can you imagine this? "This is what is done for the man." He can't be happy about this, right? He isn't doing this enthusiastically. That's how chapter 6 ends, with Haman being miserable, and he runs home to his wife to complain, and his wife tries to warn him, "Hey, things aren't looking so good for you. Do not go after Mordecai." But chapter 7 opens with this spectacular dinner party, and again the king turns to Esther and says, "What do you want? I'll give you up to half of my kingdom," and here come the tears. Right? And she says to the king, "Is this really bad man that he wants to kill me? Right? But if it was just me, I wouldn't even bother you. If it was just slavery, I'd be in slavery, but he wants to kill me and all of my people," right? And then King Xerxes says to Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he? Who would dare do this?" And Esther says, can you imagine this? "An adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman who I've invited to dinner." That's got to be an understatement. Like, he was taken off guard. And the king got up in rage and left his wine and went out into the garden. So the king is angry. But Haman realized the king had already decided his fate. He stays behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. Somehow in the process, just as the king returned from the palace to the garden banquet hall, Haman was falling onto the couch where Esther was reclining. And the king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she was with me at my house?" Right? As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And then Harbona, you got to love this guy. One of the king's eunuchs attending said to the king, said this, there's a gallows out right outside his place. A pole reaching 50 cubits high stands by Haman's house. So, hey, king, you know that guy on top of your wife right now, like trying to kill her? He built a gallows at his house. The king said, "Impale him on it." So they impaled Haman. They got the pole that was set up for Mordecai, and the king's fury subsided. And then a new law comes out, and the Jewish people are allowed to defend themselves. And Esther's faith and boldness saved the day. All right. In fact, if you're connected to the Jewish faith, there's a two-day fast even today called the Feast of Purim that celebrates this event, the day that woman power saved the Jewish race. Right? Happy Mother's Day, happily ever after. This is an amazing account of the faith and the fearlessness highlighted in the life of one amazing woman. And that's how her story ends. But remember, like right now, it's not at the end of your story. You're in the middle of your story. And here's what we all know. In the middle, it's messy. Often in the middle, we lack confidence and any certainty. Like, how do we know that if I sacrifice this, or if I choose this, or if I make my kids do this, if I stand up for this, will I get to go where I intend to go? I mean, especially when I look on social media and I compare my life or my kids or my job to everyone else, we get so insecure. And in the middle, we begin to question our calling. We question God's involvement. We question our ability to do what God has for us to do. All of that happens in the middle. In the middle, we discover that life is difficult, more difficult than we thought. We're tired, overwhelmed, and insecure. And in the middle, there are times we're ashamed of our progress. We're ashamed of our position. I'll be transparent, in the middle, sometimes it's easier to just give up. And if you're feeling any of that, I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that God has strategically positioned you. He positioned you to have the job that you have, to have the family that you have, to have the exact limited resources that you do. He even he positioned you to have the problems that you have. And who knows that you have come to this position for such a time as this. That in the middle of your life, what if you actually believe that God knows and God sees and God cares for you and He strategically positioned you just like He strategically positioned Esther? See, all it takes is one courageous decision of faith. I know you wish you were more confident, but here's the good news. In the end, we win. Like, you know that, right? If you follow Jesus, if you read the end of the story, I've read the end of the story, and in the end, the heaven is restored on earth. In the end, we win. We're just stuck right now in the middle. To which you say, Josh, that was great for her, but she's in the Bible. That's why God used her. No. You need to know that Esther had some things that she was ashamed of. The life that she was living wouldn't be qualified as godly. Like you, she was trying to figure things out. Like you, she was a part of some bad decisions. Like you, she had some stuff happen to her. In fact, in this whole account, the whole book of Esther, they never mention God once. They prayed to God, but He was seemingly silent in the middle of her story. And in the middle of your story, when you get anxious about how things might turn out, when you lie awake in the middle of the night, what should I do? When you overthink the mess of your life or people's actions or reactions. I mean, do you ever pray and pray and pray, but you're not sure how it's going to work out? Esther could say, I did that too. Me too. You're not alone. I know it's Mother's Day, and a lot of you try to come to church to hear someone like me say, God loves you and He doesn't hate you and has a plan for your life, and that's true. It's true. He wants you to make a difference in this world, and that's true. And our response outwardly is, yes, preach it, love it. But inside, maybe we're thinking, that's true for some people, and maybe even for me a long time ago, but not anymore, not based on what I've done. It's too late for God to use someone like me. I made too many mistakes. God's going to have to use somebody else. And He can do that, by the way, but He still wants to use you. To which you say, Josh, I'm unqualified and overwhelmed. Join the club. That's why I read the whole account to you. No one in the account was qualified. Everyone was overwhelmed. So I just want to give you a quick, unfiltered recap of the whole thing. Creepy Uncle Mordecai pimps out his foreign, underage, adopted orphan cousin to have beauty pageant sex with a rich guy. If she wins, she gets to be a queen. If she loses, she's a slave for the rest of her life. She didn't come from a royal family. She didn't have a huge following. She lived at the whim of a king who was known for kicking queens to the curb. And I heard that story growing up in church, but never that version. No, my Sunday school teacher cleaned that up for me because I would have remembered that. Right? Josh, you're being too graphic. I say it because I want you to know, and your mama wants you to know, your past does not disqualify your future. Your past does not disqualify your future. Now, it can if you allow it. But I promise you, in God's eyes, your past does not disqualify your future because God's grace is bigger than your sin. Josh, you don't know what I've done. No. You don't know how big God's grace is. Josh, you don't know what I can't stop doing. God's grace never stops. So let go of your excuses. Let go of your past. Maybe you didn't get to this moment in a God-honoring way, but who knows? Who knows that you've come to this moment for such a time as this? I mean, I believe with all of my heart that God has strategically positioned you for this moment in history. To which you say, for what? I don't know. It could be a decision you need to make, a relationship you need to end, a relationship you need to heal, something you need to stop doing, something you need to start doing, a sacrifice you need to make. God, could it be that God has strategically placed you in the middle of this moment where your greatest contribution isn't something you will do, it's somebody you will raise? That could be huge. I don't know what it is for you, but I do know that it will take a courageous decision of faith, where you decide to trust God, obey God, and leave the consequences up to God. I know you're in the middle, messy middle, but I believe with all of my heart that God has strategically positioned you for this moment of history, and God wants to use you and all of your baggage for such a time as this. And in the middle, it's messy. But what if you believe that even my worst fears, even if my worst fears happen, even if I lose my job, even if I let my family down, even if I fail at certain parts of my life, even if my friends don't understand or my kids don't understand, God can still use me in such a time as this. I mean, go back and look at the book of Esther. One courageous decision of faith affected her whole life. Did you catch it? She says, I want you to pray for me. And I want you to get everyone you know to pray for me. And I want to make sure that God's in this decision. And after a month of prayer and fasting, she says, if I perish, I perish. I know in the middle of the mess, we feel stuck, but in the middle of her mess, she made one courageous decision of faith. She decided to trust God, obey God, and leave the consequences up to God. And see, when we focus on our fear, we freeze. When we focus on our uncertainty, we lose confidence. But she got to the point where she actually believed, even if my greatest fear happens, even if I don't succeed, even if no one else notices, even if I don't make it out of this alive, if I perish, I perish. One courageous decision of faith that changed the course of her whole life, which leads me to ask this question. What if one courageous decision of faith could change your life forever? What if this Mother's Day, what if you actually believe that God has something he wants to do through you? He has a plan and purpose for your life, that God has strategically placed you in this moment. I mean, don't you think for a second that God wouldn't ask you to do something difficult? Don't you think for a second God wouldn't ask you to do something risky, because he would and he does. But who knows that you've come to this moment for such a time as this. I know. We all want to see miracles in our life. But we spend our whole lives trying to avoid the very context in which miracles actually happen. And right now, in the middle of your story, what if you actually believe that God has positioned you? What if all that it took was one courageous decision of faith? This Mother's Day, I want you to have the confidence that God has purpose and a plan for your life where you are right now. No matter your past, no matter your difficulty, he's positioned you for such a time as this. Would you pray with me? Father, just thank you so much for your involvement in our lives. Father, I pray that we are moved by the truth that you are with us, that you are for us. May we leave this place different, knowing maybe even what that one decision is. So, Jesus' name, I pray.